Hello, I'm Muriel, and I love true crime.
I'm Nick, and I am not a fan.
Thank you for joining us. Each week, I force Nick to listen to me tell him a story of a true crime. Welcome to Muriel's Murders. Today, we're taking a listener request. And baby, this two-part episode is for you.
Hell yeah.
We're talking sex, lies, the 1970s in Miami, the mafia, injectable poisons, and a stupid, stupid plan. For this two-part series, we're using the book Pure Evil, The Machete Murders of Macon, Georgia by Jacqueline Weldon White. Jacqueline Weldon White worked as a patrolman and detective in the South for years, and she started writing true crime after she retired and also made silver jewelry.
Okay, cool. Yeah. We got some, I know we have jewelry listeners who are into this podcast because I see them on the Instagram.
Yeah, cool. So she's a two-time Georgia Author of the Year winner. And this was her last book before she died in 2021. This book was hard to get a hold of. That's why I was so late getting this episode out. But it's the most comprehensive book on the case. And since it's the last book Jacqueline White published, I thought it would be nice to use it for the podcast.
Yeah, for sure, man. This is a little exclusive. You know, we got that rare book. I don't know anything about this. I love the laundry list of things. Mainly, you said sex, Miami, 70s mafia. I'm in, obviously.
That's why Ange suggested it. It was for Nick. It's a Nick exclusive.
Man, I love it when the ladies know my taste. You know what I mean? It makes me feel good. Muriel just gave you the craziest look. But one thing I will say, I don't know anything about the story, but I have been looking at the back of the book, and It just says, pure evil is a rush of pure terror, or something like that. Uh-huh. It's like, this story will rip your soul apart.
Yeah, it's a little brutal for those of us who are sensitive to that, so keep that in mind.
Okay, and keeping sensitivities at the forefront, we want to thank Billy F. for signing up for our Patreon. Yeah. Murders Muriels is currently an ad-free podcast, and the only way we bring in money is when listeners like Billy and listeners like you sign up for Patreon or subscribe to our Spotify feed. You get the bonus episodes. We get the dollars and encouragement to keep pumping out episodes. Thank you, Billy. Thank you to all our supporters. And thank you to every one of you listeners who are going to either press pause, or you can actually do it while you continue to listen, who are going to just stop what they're doing, like slam on their brakes, cause a huge accident in traffic, whatever it is, and sign up right now. Links in the show notes, or you can go to murielsmurders.com for all the info. We love you.
Nice. Very articulate. All right. This is a true...
Was I not? Was I mumbling? No. Okay.
There was a point where I almost lost the plot, but okay. Maybe that was just me. Sorry. I didn't mean to be so snarky. Jeez Louise, Muriel. This is a true story involving murder, violence, drugs, adult themes, etc. So if any listeners are like Nick, they don't like hearing about those kind of things, please consider listening to a different podcast.
We're going to joke. We're going to curse around. That's upsetting us to... you're right. Now I can't talk at all. You know, if you don't like people joking or cursing when it comes to like talking about true crimes, turn us off.
All right. Nikki, are you ready to hear this story?
No.
Okay. Let's get started. All right. August 31st, 1974 in Macon, Georgia. This is about 70 miles northeast of where The Walking Dead was filmed.
Okay.
So if you're like Nick and you've seen that show, picture like that during the summertime. It's a really gorgeous area despite the zombies in that show.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
It's lush, green. You have the sound of cicadas. There are these like thick stands of trees everywhere, waving in the breeze, waiting for the zombies to come out.
At times, it's rolling hills.
Yeah. And like Rick Grimes.
Okay. The Walking Dead lead character.
You might have an eerie sense that the worst thing ever is about to happen. So right now, it's around 7 p.m., the golden hour right before sunset, and Quentin Cotton is cruising the sky above Macon, Georgia in a Cessna 172, and he's desperately searching for a dead body. Mm. Quentin was a pilot for Pan American Airlines, and that Saturday evening, he had rented the little plane to take his fiance and her sisters for a ride. And Quentin's brother was building a house in this brand new subdivision. There were a lot of them popping up around Georgia. So the group thought it would be fun to fly over the house and have a look, like they're building a pool and they're like, oh, we, you know, check out the house.
Okay, great. Yeah. I mean, that's so baller.
I know.
So you want to see our new property? You want to see it from the sky?
Well, and like back in 1974, apparently it was like $24 to rent a plane.
Yeah. It's like, hey, if you can fly it, man, just take it. Yeah.
So they buzzed over the house a few times. And then Quentin, who's a grown-ass pilot, but still into fun, saw some deer in a field and decided, hey, I'm going to try to terrorize these deer that were like grazing. So he swoops down in this little plane and he chases the deer off into the woods. And as he like pulls up to avoid crashing into the woods, he sees something out of the corner of his eye. He sees this white Ford sedan parked in a half-finished cul-de-sac of a new suburban subdivision. And next to the sedan, on the ground, was the body of a man lying on his stomach, shot in the back of the head. And there was blood everywhere. A pair of legs belonging to a second body hung stiffly out of the driver's side door. So he pulls up into the sky and he starts screaming at the other people in the plane, did you see that? Nobody sees it. And so now he tries to like frantically retrace his steps in the air to see if what he saw was actually real.
Oh, I hope he doesn't crash. Does he crash? No, he doesn't crash.
He does not crash.
Okay.
So police arrived on the scene that Quentin Cotton reported to find the bodies of two people. A man had been shot in the chest and head next to this white sedan. And in the front seat, a woman had been shot in the face while attempting to radio for help. So her arms were up in a defensive position and her wrists were shattered. It wasn't a robbery.
Wait, what does that mean? Arms up in a... So she put her hands up to block her face and someone...
Shot her that way with a shotgun.
What do you mean radioed?
So at this particular car, we'll find out, but the person who owned the car worked for Southern Natural Gas, and so they had, and they worked on pipelines, so they had a company radio in the car.
Man,
and this is before cell phones.
Right, this is old school original car phones, basically.
Yeah.
Sick. I mean, RIP, that's horrible, but also that's cool that they have that in their car.
I don't know. Just focus on the
story. Okay.
So it wasn't a robbery. Their wallets were totally intact. There wasn't anything missing. But in the man's front pocket, there was a note. Directions to the murder site. So this showed the investigators that someone, whoever had shot the couple, had lured them out of their home and to this cul-de-sac in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, it would look like that.
And it looked kind of like a hit. Whoever had shot the couple had carefully collected all of the shotgun shells, and there wasn't any murder weapon on scene, right? Mm-hmm. So there wasn't anything immediately apparent. The couple were identified fairly quickly because of a coincidence. Chief Deputy Ray Wilkes ID'd the bodies as soon as he came on the scene because Ronnie and Juanita Akins were locals. They had been married about 3 weeks earlier, and the newlyweds had just rented an apartment from Sheriff Wilkes to start their new lives.
Oh, damn. Okay. That's a crazy coincidence.
So for the victim, Ronnie Akins, 1974 had been a really rough year. Mm. He was pushing 40, newly divorced, and had lost custody of his three daughters after a nasty split from his high school sweetheart, Becky Akins. Ronnie was broke because of the amount of child support he was paying, and then he also lost his home and, his car. So he was broke and living in a tiny apartment in Macon when that spring he met 28-year-old Juanita Knight, an elementary school teacher from Athens, Georgia. So Juanita was from a fancy Georgia family. She's college educated. She's really pretty, kind. Mm-hmm. Ronnie was more than 10 years older than her, but Juanita was into it. And the two got engaged really quickly and were married in early August, about 5 months after his divorce from Becky. Ronnie and Juanita really didn't have any public enemies. Juanita was a beloved school teacher. Ronnie had worked in the community for decades as a TV repairman and pipeline technician for Southern Natural Gas. Ronnie had also been a popular late night local DJ on the radio. He was known as Lonesome Ronnie, spinning country hits.
Oh, that's, man. R.I.P. Ronnie.
Yeah.
Both of them. This is crazy. This is horrible. Okay. So you're making them just sound like the nicest, best people of all time.
Okay. Well, as is the case most of the time, when there isn't an obvious killer, investigators zeroed in on those closest to the couple. Mm-hmm. In particular, Ronnie's ex-wife, Becky. So Ronnie was a senior at Athens High School in Georgia when he met 16-year-old sophomore Rebecca Turpin. Becky was fun, outgoing, and chatty. Ronnie was really bright and quiet. Ronnie actually learned how to fly small aircraft in his teens and spent a ton of time at the local airfield, like working and flying planes.
Did he know the guy that discovered the body?
No.
Okay.
But he definitely flew out of the same airfield, mm-hmm. renting planes and doing exactly the same thing.
Sure. Okay.
In fact, we'll find out later, he actually had rented a plane that very day. And I think from what I've read, he was actually the youngest person to ever fly out of that particular airfield.
Sure. So this guy's 16. DJing, he's flying in the air.
Yeah, and he's a tinkerer. He was like a repairman, so he did tons of stuff like that. So he graduated from high school and worked as a TV repairman in Athens while Becky finished up high school. And then during her senior year, Becky got pregnant and the couple eloped and got married. So they had a bunch of kids really quickly in succession. Becky gave birth to Victoria Ramona in February 1957, and she got pregnant like weeks later and gave birth to Valerie Ronda in January 1958. So her kids were like less than a year apart.
Yeah, right. Irish twins, it's called.
Yeah, I think that's offensive now, but I hear you.
My bad.
Their last kid, Vanessa Rebecca, was born October 1960. So, 3 kids in, 3 years or something. Mm. But in the end, the couple had this gaggle of curly-headed blonde ladies to start off their life. In the beginnings, things were fine, but the marriage deteriorated over the years. As far as anyone knew, they had normal couple fights, maybe compounded by getting married and having kids so young. Who knows? At any rate, the marriage ran its course, and Ronnie filed for divorce in 1973. In February 1974, after 18 years of marriage, Becky and Ronnie Aiken's divorce was finalized. Ronnie moved on, like we said, fairly quickly. He met a new woman, and in late spring of 1974, about 3 months after his divorce was finalized, he was already engaged to Juanita Knight. Now, just weeks after Ronnie's engagement, Becky, who had lived her entire life in Georgia as a housewife, abruptly pulled her 3 daughters out of school and moved them to sunny Miami, Florida. Becky had full custody of the girls, and she was still waiting for her portion of the sale of the family home. So she used her child support payments and then a bunch of Alan's credit cards to just go to Miami, live the high life, and rent a suite at the beachfront Aztec Motel to start her new life.
Damn, these guys got divorced and were like, he was like, I got a new wife. She's younger. And this girl's like, I live in Miami now.
Yeah, I live in Miami now.
I'm a baller.
See you later.
Yeah, and DJ Khaled are kicking it. Let's go.
Why Miami, do you ask, Nicholas?
Why Miami, do I ask?
Well, one of the huge draws for Becky was Miami had a ton of Italians.
Oh, yeah. We'll bring it. We'll, you know, we're magnetic. You know, they come find us.
Castellini.
Yes.
While Becky wasn't Italian herself, she was a big honking Italophile, which was something the family was well aware of. Ever since her daughters could remember, their mother was super open about how she felt Italians were the most glamorous people on earth. And she tried really hard to like cosplay as being Italian. Like she would just slather herself in baby oil, fry her skin to a golden brown at every opportunity to get that Mediterranean look. She also kind of like vacillated between dark, like wearing her hair really dark, dyeing it dark black and wearing really heavy makeup or like the bleach blonde Carmela Soprano look, like just, sure, you know, whatever. So she kind of went back and forth between the two.
Okay.
So Becky moved to Miami in late May. Now listen how jam-packed 1974 is. Late May 1974. And not to be outdone, 2 months after moving to Miami and just days before her ex-husband's planned marriage, Becky was like, I'm going to remarry too.
They've really had a lot bottled up over those 18 years.
So on July 27th, 1974, Becky was like two middle fingers to the sky, and she married an insurance salesman from New Jersey going by the name of Anthony Isaldo Machete.
I do want to say one thing real quick. When you said, why Miami? I already knew the answer was because of the Italians.
How'd you know?
I don't know. I just know.
Oh my goodness.
I just get it. I just got a sense of Becky, you know? She's just talking to me for a second, you know?
So they got hitched in a lavish ceremony in the Starlight Room on the roof of the Doral Hotel. They pulled out all the stops. They even served filet mignon, which some of the guests had never even tasted before. Mm-hmm. So it was a big splashy wedding. And this obviously was not the first marriage for either the bride or the groom, who were both in their 40s. Tony was a slight man, balding with a dark mustache. He wore a powder blue tuxedo trimmed in black with these huge, like, obscene shoulder width 70s style lapels, and then a wildly ruffled shirt topped with an oversized black bow tie, and then these very cool like cherry red tinted glasses.
I need that outfit. Are you kidding me right now?
Becky was a larger, stout, and handsome woman with huge wig-like curly bleach blonde hair. She wore a Barbie pink and white wedding dress with a bright chiffon veil, like a pink chiffon veil, and these big puffy pink sleeves, and she like capped off the whole ensemble with this bright blue baby eyeshadow.
I think I want us to cosplay as these people cosplaying as mobsters or whatever this whatever that thing is. That's what we need to be pretending to be.
I'm so into it. Back in Georgia, Ronnie and Juanita were married just a few days later in a little ceremony at the Belmont Baptist Church in Athens. It's
complete opposite. She's all a kindergarten teacher.
This was a fruit punch and cake kind of wedding. Lots of flowers, traditional white dress. No one wore tinted cool guy glasses.
No filet mignon.
Yeah. So they honeymooned in Tennessee. They spent some time in Nashville and then camping in the mountains. And then 3 weeks after the wedding, they were murdered.
It's horrible. It's unreal.
Back to the investigation. While the killer had managed to hide some of the evidence, there was plenty for investigators to go off of. Ronnie's car engine was still warm to the touch, so they had a good sense of what the timeline was.
Okay, so definitely the guy in the plane didn't do the killing. And then it's like, oops, I found this body. Can't be me.
Yes, exactly. Okay.
Because I was like, this guy, oh, I'm going to go chase some deers. Ooh, I just happened to see that thing.
No, it was an accident. Okay. I mean, one thing we'll talk about is that whoever committed this killing, which we'll find out at the end of this, chose a spot that they thought was very remote and in the middle of nowhere, but actually was not at all remote and surrounded by people.
Okay. That makes me seem like he's an out-of-towner.
There were palm prints on the hood of the sedan that didn't belong to the couple, so they already had fingerprints to look at. And like I said, the spot seemed rural and empty, but the hills had eyes. There were witnesses. A retired couple living nearby had actually seen a story in pictures that day. That evening, while washing their car outside around 5 p.m., they saw two guys drive a green 1974 Gremlin with a yellow racing stripe down the street towards the woods.
An all-time great car.
Then a few minutes later, a white Ford sedan with a smiling, waving woman in the passenger seat drove down the road in the same direction. Mm-hmm. They said a few minutes later, they heard shotgun blasts, which actually was super common. People loved to go to this random patch of woods and shoot off their guns. That was something that happened a lot.
Maybe some deer hunting. It sounds like they're just chilling.
Yeah, or doing it for funsies, like whatever you want to do.
Yeah.
After the gunshots, the couple said they saw the green Gremlin head back the way it came, but no white sedan. There were two men in the front seat of the Gremlin. The car had Florida license plates, and because their house stood near a stop sign, the couple got a good look at the driver of the Gremlin when the car paused. Mm-hmm. So lots and lots of information. The Florida license plate rang some bells, so investigators decided to track down old Becky in Miami.
Sure.
And they didn't have to wait long. On Monday, 2 days after the murder, Deputy Sheriff Ray Wilkes was surprised to get a call from Becky Machetti herself. By now, Becky had transformed from this stifled Georgia housewife to Italian-esque Miami high roller.
Italian-esque.
Her look was basically like, if you've seen The Sopranos, her look was basically Tony Soprano's sister Janice, but with short, very fried, peroxided blonde hair.
Oh, hilarious.
Honestly, the pictures are so similar and so like so strikingly similar. I literally looked at it and I was like, oh, that's Janice.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Amazing.
And Becky had a lot to tell Deputy Sheriff Ray Wilkes. She said her mother had called her already to tell her all about Ronnie's death. And she wanted everyone to know she had been in Florida all weekend. So she wasn't trying to hear any rumors about being a murderer. Right off the bat.
She's like, you guys are always blaming us. Us Italians. We're the problem for everything. You guys just point to us and say, oh, they did it.
She was calling the deputy sheriff because she was like, I can't get any calls. I can't get any incoming calls at her rental house because her phone had been shut off. So she had to communicate throughout this entire story. She has to communicate everything from the payphone at the nearby Jefferson's department store.
What, shut off because you didn't pay her bill or because?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Becky had a solid alibi that weekend, full of McDonald's lunches and poolside lounging in Miami. And she said her husband had been on a fishing trip with a friend. So her household was all locked down.
Fishing trip with a friend?
Already, off the bat.
a bunch of New Jersey guys just going around the Florida marshland.
She said her new husband, Tony, was an insurance executive from New Jersey who now worked with Lloyd's of London in Miami. A big step up from her deadbeat ex, Ronnie. May he rest in peace.
I just feel like you just threw in a little bit of like
an accent. I felt myself doing it. I was like, Muriel, stop. It's just in it. Now I can't stop.
Sounded like Drea Di Matteo.
Mm-hmm. She has an OnlyFans now.
I know.
PBS.
I know. Give me a credit card, you know?
Okay. Give you a credit card. No.
What's that number, girl? Read it off to me.
So she says all of this stuff. Like she unloads all of this information on this deputy sheriff. Mm-hmm. And at the end, she says, also, I have a theory as to what happened to Ronnie.
Okay.
Want to take a guess?
What theory does she tell the police she has?
Yeah.
I don't know. No, his new wife's family is crooked.
Drugs.
Okay.
Becky told Deputy Sheriff Wilkes that Ronnie was actually a low-key, long-time drug addict. Anything he could get his hands on, heroin, pills, like whatever. Mm-hmm. And Becky told him that the previous summer, Ronnie had overdosed something like 4 times in their house. And she had some training as a nurse. So she said, I nursed him back to health after every overdose. And eventually she said that's why she divorced him. She said Ronnie was also a cog in the Macon, Georgia underworld. And for the past year and a half, he'd been running heroin from Atlanta to Macon. According to Becky, Ronnie had dumped about a kilo of heroin during a surprise roadside police checkpoint last year. And now he owed big time drug dealers, get this, $8,000.
So she just has no idea what she's talking about. Kilos of heroin.
Maybe this gave you pause. Yeah. Maybe it gave some of our listeners pause. It definitely gave Ray Wilkes pause because, yeah. Okay, so it's kind of like when Dr. Evil from Austin Powers tried to ransom the planet for $1 million and everyone laughed at him.
Yeah.
According to a 1975 New York Times article, one that I just pulled off the internet, in 1975, the wholesale price for a kilo of heroin in the U.S. would range between $40,000 and $70,000, and the street value would be over $600,000. So this $8,000 number gave the impression Becky might be playing make-em-ups.
Yes.
Becky went on to say, like, high on her sort of, like, cool high roller kilos of heroin situation.
In Miami 1 week, she's just like,
it's literally
she's happened. Like Rick Ross all of a sudden.
Becky went on to say, you know, she didn't know much about the drug deal, except that Ronnie worked for a man named Darrow and a one-armed homosexual painter called K.P. Carroll, who Ronnie was having an affair with.
Okay. She's like, look, I didn't kill him. I don't need you guys bad mouthing Italians, but let me go ahead and just tell you all the reasons my ex-husband deserved to die.
Yes. Yes. Right. I think that's about what's going on now.
Makes her seem so guilty immediately.
None of this matched what investigators had been told about Ronnie Akins. But if this was some brilliant attempt at avoiding suspicion, Becky had accidentally put on a clown wig. While none of what she said turned out to be supported with any evidence, she certainly put a target on her back. So next up, investigators talked to a few other interesting characters. Alan Barfield was in his mid-20s and engaged to Becky and Ronnie's middle daughter, 17-year-old Valerie. And he had actually just come home from a baffling weekend in Miami with the family. So while Ronnie and Juanita Akins were murdered in Georgia, he was actually in Miami with Becky and all the girls.
Right, at this family he's might be marrying into soon.
Right. Okay. So Alan and Valerie had been doing a long distance relationship since the girls moved to Florida. So Alan lived in Macon, Georgia. Mm-hmm. Alan had already gotten permission from Valerie's parents for the marriage, and the wedding was actually scheduled for the winter of 1974. So it was just a few months away. But recently, Becky had thrown a wrench into the whole thing. She called up Alan and she demanded that Alan come to Florida to get permission from Valerie's new stepdad, Tony Machete, that very weekend. So Alan, thinking, if I don't do this, I'm not going to be able to get married, he went and got a payday loan, like a personal loan, to buy a last-minute plane ticket to fly to Miami, only to find out that Tony Machete had already left for a weekend fishing trip with his friend John Murray, a younger Burt Reynolds-looking guy with a bushy mustache and shaggy hair. So Alan, you know, back in Georgia, he tells investigators the weekend was pretty weird. Everyone was kind of tense. And then at the end, when Tony and John Murray got home, their fishing gear was totally untouched. And, you know, most notably, they didn't have no fish.
No, well, fish. It's not their, I mean, they're from New Jersey. You know, they, I would be shocked if they had caught fish.
Yeah.
And, but, you know,
yeah.
What? Go ahead.
We can't catch fish.
No, of course we can't. No one can catch fish. It's impossible. I call extreme BS for all these people. Like, oh, I caught fish. No.
It's so
what hard. What is the it's magic so that you speak of?
So he came home and he never got that permission to marry Valerie. Investigators also spoke with a concerned former coworker of Ronnie Akins who said Becky had recently called him super aggressive, not taking no for an answer, looking for Ronnie and Juanita's new address. And then finally, they spoke with Becky's new husband, Tony, which was great because he had been avoiding the police up until now. So Tony, in his interview, was really cagey. He was quiet, and he largely stuck to the alibi that Becky had laid out. He embellished it a little bit. He said, oh, we went out. We were maybe going to go fishing, but really it was a speculative, real estate thing. And he's like, so we just went around looking at different properties.
Okay.
So he made it kind of fancier.
Right. But also not like in an area long enough to be seen by other people or something.
Right. And actually, he also said that he and John Murray slept in their car, only ate sandwiches, and paid cash for everything. So they had no record at all of their alibi.
Great.
He said they're going on a hot shot real estate scouting mission with their fishing poles and sleeping in the car. So, great.
Sleeping in the car, just checking out high rises.
It's just like it just keeps giving and giving.
So you guys have a parking lot here, and is that attached to this address? Because we need to catch some Z's.
The other thing about Tony was that wasn't actually his real name.
Mm-hmm.
Turned out Tony was the less Italian sounding John Eldon Smith.
I don't think you can say the word Tony without being Sopranos all of a sudden.
Tony. Shut up. He told police he was in the process of having his name legally changed to Anthony Esraldo Machete at the request of his wife, but the application was still pending. He said Becky thought he looked more like a Tony than a John. Plus, he wanted to be a bartender in Miami and make big bucks, but he was sure no one could get a job like that in Miami without an Italian-sounding name. So forget the Lords of London and the insurance executive thing.
Right, all the real estate now. Let's make some pina coladas.
Also, by the way, throughout this meeting, even after his name was officially legally changed and into his trial, they always called him John Eldon Smith. Nobody would respect him.
Not Italian. Also, just
they were like, "No, we're not doing that."
So yeah, I tan well. What do you want from me?
The next day, Wednesday, Ronnie and Juanita's funerals were held in Macon, Georgia, and Becky banned their daughters from attending. On Thursday, investigators had a big break in the case, a potential financial motive. Ronnie Akins had a $53,000 life insurance policy, so not huge, it's pretty modest, but it was there. Over half of it, about $29,000, would go to his parents, and the rest was intended to be split among his daughters. He also had $1,500 in stocks, and then, of course, the Social Security death benefit for the girls until they turned 18. So the girls would all get $113 a month.
Mm-hmm.
So really not like life-changing money or anything, but it was something. Investigators got their hands on this mysterious John Murray from the fishing trip and got fingerprints and photos of him and Tony. And the rest sort of fell together just like butter. The eyewitnesses from the scene of the murder picked John Murray out of a 15-person photo lineup as the driver of the green gremlin with the racing stripe. And surprise, on October 11th, the analysis of the palm print from the hood of Ronnie Akins' car came back a positive match for Mr. John Murray.
Did they track down the car? It's just in his garage.
They couldn't find it.
Oh, really?
It was a rental.
Okay.
And some of these things I had to cut down for time. But they couldn't find it for a while. So they were missing pieces of the puzzle. October 15th. 1974, arrest warrants were issued for Becky, Tony, and John Murray. A search of Becky and Tony's rental home yielded guns, hella wigs, a letter from John Murray to Becky demanding a $1,000 payment for some sort of mysterious service he wouldn't name in the letter. Like all kinds of goodies, right?
$1,000.
And all three mega minds were eventually taken into custody and extradited to Georgia. So when they get to Georgia, the very first person to break was the man fingered by eyewitnesses and caught with his palm prints at the crime scene, John Murray. And this is his story. John Murray had met Becky back in June 1974 when she first moved to Miami. Basically, Becky hooked up with these two Johns back to back. So she met the older John Eldon Smith, aka Tony, on June 1st while he was vacationing from New Jersey. And then what?
I just love it. She's like, I got to go down there to meet some Italians. And then all she's just like, can't, like, none of the Italian dudes want to hook up with her. So she just finds some other guy who also is trying to pretend to be Italian.
That's pretty much literally what happened.
It's very funny.
The 44-year-old man was a married insurance salesman working on, I believe, his third divorce. He was a smaller guy losing his hair, but he made it up with elaborate facial hair and big mutton chop sideburns and this poofy mustache. John Eldon Smith and Becky spent a passionate night together, and in the morning, they were talking marriage. He flew back to New Jersey, and then that night after he left, Becky went back to the same bar to do some more mingling, right? Maybe meet some sort of Italian guy. Okay. This time, she ran into John Murray, who was in Miami on what he called a, quote, open vacation. Murray was also married, working on a divorce, and he had recently come into a little money. He had sold a custodial business in the, like, locally. He also worked part-time for a pyramid scheme called America Be Independent, which I just love that name.
America Be Independent, like... Is it like a directive? America, be independent.
I don't know. I'm sure that that's what it is, but I just think it's very strange. It's like a real estate. So that might've been what they were scouting.
That's hilarious.
It's like a real estate pyramid scheme.
It's kind of like ahead of its time for internet speak. You know, it's like America, be independent.
Right. But it's really America, be independent, but there's no comma. So
it's just, yeah, I mean, it's just pyramid scheme chaos.
John Murray was about 10 years younger than Becky, with flowing locks and a serious 70s stash. So while Becky cultivated a long distance relationship with John Eldon Smith through letters while he was back in New Jersey, she moved John Murray into her suite at the Aztec Hotel.
Ooh, little love triangle.
There, Murray was sort of a Guy Friday, right? Part freeloader, part side chick, part questionable nanny for Becky's teenaged girls, and then part gambling partner.
Wait, what is Guy Friday?
It's like your person who does whatever. It's like a jack of all trades.
But for, like, in the lover sphere, like,
no,
romantic,
no, no.
It could be anything.
He does all kinds of stuff.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because then you went on to name a bunch of cool things.
Oh, yeah. Well, kind of. Questionable nanny.
Well,
right.
I don't know about that part. I mean, is he just drunk or is he doing, like, inappropriate
things?
I mean,
she just met this guy and started having sex with him. And then, he's a gambler. And then she goes, anytime she wants to do anything, she's like, now you're in charge of the girl.
Okay. Yeah.
Or some other accent. Okay.
You know what accent you want to do.
I know, but I don't have control over it. Okay, so John Murray and Becky spent most of their time together down at the racetracks, the horse racing tracks, because that's where she said that's where you're going to meet all the high rolling Italian guys.
Sure.
And they were developing a highly intelligent way of earning a living. John's strategy was bet way too much money on the first race.
Uh-huh.
That way, if you win, you can quit for the day. But if you lose, bet even more money on the second race to cover your losses.
Okay.
Rinse and repeat as long as it takes to win. Totally foolproof.
Until, all that custodial money dries up.
John Murray said eventually Becky married John Eldon Smith. And in fact, just for the record, even though the men barely knew each other, John Murray was John Eldon Smith's best man at their wedding.
Oh, yeah. So they all just jumped into this new life. It's just like people in the 70s were like, I'm divorced? I'm going crazy. What? It's just like their head turns into like Sprite.
Then about a month after the wedding, they're all hanging out, right? They're living their life. He's there. They're moving around. Something's happening. It is what it is, right? Yeah. About a month after the wedding, John Murray said Becky laid out her plan for killing Ronnie Akins. One night, Becky, John Eldon Smith, who by now was going by Tony completely, and John Murray were chilling in the living room drinking when Becky came out with a glass vial of some sort of liquid drug and a syringe. And she told the men, it's time. We need to kill Ronnie Akins. So she tells them the plan is that they're going to break into Ronnie's apartment and inject him with these mystery drugs to make it look like he'd overdosed. John Eldon Smith was all like nodding, like, yeah, okay, cool, cool, cool. Like they had discussed it before, but Murray said he was just blindsided and totally
it's like, you want to kill someone? Yeah. I thought we were just having threesomes. What's going on here?
Investigators then ask Murray the burning question, right? Why did Becky want to kill Ronnie? Was it for money, like the insurance money, or for, was it for revenge for divorcing her and getting married so quickly, right? And John Murray replied, actually, it was to self-initiate John Eldon Smith, a.k.a. Tony Machete,
no, not into the mafia. The mafia. do a pointless murder that benefits literally no one in some different state, and then all these guys will think you're Italian, and then you get to be in the cool kids club.
The whole thing started with Becky's obsession for being Italian American, or whatever she thought that was, based on books and movies. Remember, in 1972, The Godfather Part One, directed by Francis Ford Coppola, came out and blew everybody's minds, right? The next year, Martin Scorsese came out with Mean Streets, and there were all these other movies coming out, like Dillinger and The Outfit, Gang of War and Milan. Like, all of these people were making gangster movies. We were obsessed.
Mafia
with,
mania.
With mafia movies. According to John Murray, Becky developed a plan to get into the mafia based on what she learned from movies, because Al Pacino made it look so freaking cool.
Yeah, I mean, if anything, the only thing that you actually have to do is be literally born into the family.
That's not what she said.
It's just so funny to miss the most painfully obvious part.
If you're familiar with The Godfather, right? John Eldon Smith and Becky both thought they were Michaels, right? The Godfather. But John Eldon Smith was way more of a Fredo, and Becky was like early Connie mixed with Sonny when he was being an asshole. So, you know, decidedly also not mafia material. Like, if you were going to pick someone who's like Michael from The Godfather, you know, someone as cool and calm and collected as Al Pacino in that role, you're definitely not going to pick these two Muppets to go around and be like, that's us, right?
It's so sad.
Nonetheless, The Godfather was their blueprint for success. An obviously totally realistic set of guidelines for how to get mobbed up. First, they worked really, really hard on coming up with a new name for John Eldon Smith. That was absolutely not going to cut it. She was not going to be married to a man named John Smith.
I cannot wait for how they came up with Machete.
Well, they came up with Anthony Isaraldo Machete, and this was double awesome because Machete sort of sounds like machete with a fake Italian accent, and guess what the initials spell?
I can't remember.
AIM. A-I-M. So for a hitman,
you know it's
perfect.
So, you know it's
right?
Really funny. Yeah, yeah. What's so funny is when I saw Machete, I was like, and I'm sure there are some real Machetes out there.
I Googled it too, because I was like, is
are there real Machetes?
There are, but it's not super common name.
I mean, Castellini is also like a name that's like invented by the government.
Well, so there's a lot of Castellini.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, so I get it. It's not, you know, I'm one to talk for sure to an extent. But Machete, I was like, that seems like an AI generated.
Well, it's like somebody trying to sound super badass. Yeah, so right. Like Machete, AIM, Hitman, very cool.
Absolutely hilarious. This is good. This is amazing.
So Becky convinced her new husband that once he was in the mafia, he could command any price he wanted for a hit. But he had to prove himself first to show he was a killer, and murdering her horrible drug addict ex-husband was the perfect way to do it. So the plan was for John Alden Smith, a.k.a. Tony,
a.k.a. AIM,
to murder Ronnie Akins, and for John Murray to act as the getaway driver. Becky planned on paying Murray $1,000 to drive Tony to Macon, Georgia and back. And that was money he actually really needed, given his terrible betting strategy.
He's got to get down to the ponies.
Yeah.
Becky, they have no idea. None of these people know what money is. They're like, $8,000 for, like, I don't know, all of the heroin in the world? He's like, yeah, I'll drive someone across state lines to murder someone and back for $1,000? Yeah, that sounds good.
So they got ready, right? Becky, who had trained as a nurse at some point in her life, she was not a nurse, but she had trained at some point, taught her new husband how to do these poison injections. And then she spent a big chunk of time teaching both guys how to knock someone out with the butt of a handgun, like people do in the movies. And she had a whole plan written out, directions to Ronnie's house, a backup plan if the poison injection plan didn't work out. Their alibi would be a fishing trip, and then her alibi would be staying hundreds of miles away in Florida with unsuspecting Alan Barfield, the fiance, thrown in as an extra alibi witness.
Okay.
Friday, August 30th, John Murray and the man we'll call Tony from here on out grabbed some fishing equipment, poison, and syringes, and picked up their very subtle green gremlin rental car with the yellow racing stripe. From there, they headed north to Georgia to commit what would turn out to be a shockingly violent and poorly planned double murder.
It's horrible. R.I.P.
Tony and Marie got to Macon, Georgia before dawn, and with Becky's instructions, they easily found Ronnie and Juanita's apartment. So first, Tony got out of the car and obviously pulled out a pair of white murdering gloves.
Okay.
And put them on. And then he pulled a briefcase with the poison in it out of the car and then went sneaking around the Akins apartment, just trying knobs and handles on all the windows and doors. So just seeing if anything's open. Not at all suspicious. After Tony realized everything was locked up for the night, he went back to the car, totally out of ideas. And the guys are discussing, like, okay, what do we do? We could knock on the door and then force our way inside and then inject them, or like, what's going on? So they're planning, and that's when the paper boy delivering the morning papers drives his car into the parking lot. So he splashes the entire scene in headlights and then pulls his car right up next to the gremlin, gets out and starts delivering papers. So the guys are sitting there with their white murdering gloves on and this briefcase, and the paper boy keeps coming back and forth to the car. So they're like, okay,
yeah,
cover's blown, we gotta get out of here. They jump back in the gremlin, and by now they're just super tired. They had driven the whole night. So they're deciding to look for a spot to pull over and take a nap. They ended up parking on a suburban street just somewhere in Macon, Georgia. Tony slept while John Murray sat there being super paranoid about all the people out walking their dogs and taking note of the green gremlin with out of town license plates. Later that morning.
Yeah, these two guys were in there. They were just like making a marinara, I think. They just had like all of these meatballs.
Being racist. Later that morning, the guys pulled out Becky's plan B. Okay, so this was also Becky's plan. Lure Ronnie Akins to a secluded area and inject him there. So the guys drove to a convenience store and they used a payphone to call Ronnie's house with the phone number that Becky gave him. Tony was super pleasant on the phone, laying out his fake story and asking Ronnie, hey man, like, I hear you install TV antennas. I just finished building my house in one of the new subdivisions. Can you come out there and install the TV antenna? I'll pay you cash. It's Sunday. Ronnie had decided he was going to spend the whole day with his new wife, Juanita.
Yeah.
So he really didn't want to do it. But he said he'd think about it. He had plans that morning to rent a single engine plane at the airfield and take Juanita flying. So while Ronnie and Juanita were flying around over Macon, Tony and Murray drove all around Macon in their green gremlin looking for a newly constructed home in a rural area.
It is the least conspicuous car.
I know. It's
like, it might as well be the Batmobile.
It's especially with Florida plates. It's just like, what are you talking about? So Tony goes back to the convenience store. Again, they're just like going back to the same place.
Yeah.
And he calls the Aiken house again around 2 p.m. And he finds Ronnie and Juanita are home from the airfield and, you know, hanging out at their house. So Ronnie agrees this time to install the cable at 5 p.m. that night and then wrote down the directions that Tony gave him on a piece of paper, folded it up and put it in his front pocket. Tony and John Murray then decided, hey, we don't have anything else to do. So they took themselves out to lunch at a diner to pass the time. And they had a big lunch. At the last minute, just before 5 p.m., Juanita decided to ride with Ronnie to his gig. They followed the instructions Ronnie had written down to a wooded area in North Macon and pulled into the cul-de-sac where two men were waiting in a green gremlin. Tony and Murray both got out of the gremlin with the intention that Tony would be doing the killing and Murray would keep his hands clean. So the whole thing starts out pretty wonky. Tony is supposed to now inject two people with poison, right? That's the plan.
Yeah, I mean, what even is it? That's
it's so like some
stupid
sort of sedative. It's something. It was something she had gotten from a doctor, but
I don't mean what is specifically the poison. I just mean
like what?
How? Also,
you're gonna go. He's single-handedly. He's gonna subdue two people and inject them with enough poison to kill them with this syringe. So he has this briefcase. It has the poison in it. He has a gun, and I think his plan. What it seems like his plan is to get them subdued by just doing it by gunpoint and then opening the briefcase and injecting them.
Oh, okay.
I still don't think that's
yeah, I mean, point. That definitely wasn't in The Godfather.
So Tony came out at the couple waving a gun and screaming at them to put their hands on the hood and thinking it's a robbery, you know, instead of doing that, Ronnie goes for his wallet and he starts trying to defuse the situation, which is not what Tony needs, right?
Yeah.
So Tony decides he's got to subdue this guy one way or the other. So he tries whacking Ronnie in the back of the head with his handgun like Becky taught him. But it was a disaster because as soon as he hit Ronnie, blood started spraying everywhere. But Ronnie didn't go down.
Yeah.
He wasn't knocking out. And so, you know, Tony doesn't know what to do. And instead of subduing Ronnie, he's trying to get up. And Juanita is just like screaming in this, you know, open space. So Tony called to Murray for help keeping Juanita quiet. He said, you know, you got to help me get over here. And Murray said he felt like he was underwater. He just was moving really slowly. He couldn't get himself together. So he walked over and he managed to grab a wooden surveillance stake out of the ground. And he sort of hit Juanita in the head with it weakly. She just ignored him and jumped in the car to radio for help on Ronnie's company radio. At this point, Tony abandoned the whole poison injection thing and instead pulled out a shotgun out of the gremlin and headed back to the couple. Tony shot Juanita in the face and then shot Ronnie in the chest and head while Murray stood there with his back turned.
It is unbelievable to me how many of these stories just come down to, like, I get it, the book's called Pure Evil. It's so stupid.
Yeah.
Like, they're so, like, their minds are small. They're not skilled. It's so pointless and so stupid. It's idiotic. And it just destroys these two human souls.
Yeah. Murray was the getaway driver, right? But he was having trouble pulling it together. He had never even been arrested up until this point. So he gets in the car and he starts driving really slowly and carefully through the subdivision, pausing at all the traffic signs on the empty road when he stopped at a stop sign and looked up to see an elderly couple washing their car staring at him. And instead of driving away, Murray freaked out and tried to cover his face with his hands while Tony screamed at him to drive. So they got a very extensive look at these two guys who were having a heart attack.
Yes.
Finally, they got it together enough to drive away. In the car, Tony was feeling good. Murray said he ripped up Becky's instructions and threw them out the window. He changed his clothes.
The kill my husband instructions. He ripped into what, 12 pieces?
Changed his clothes. And then he said, you know, Tony chatted with him about like, oh, you know, I wasn't intending to use the shotgun. Like the shotgun belongs to my father. So I'm not going to like destroy this evidence. I'm just going to bury it so I can get it back later. Cause I want to like still have it. Okay.
It's a good gun. And when he's in the mafia, they're probably going to ask him to use it all the time.
Yeah. Overall, Tony was content. They'd done a great job, just like professionals. Little did they know, at that very moment, the spot they thought was remote enough to conceal a couple of bodies was swarmed with police after a man spotted the murder scene from the air, and then also a couple of teens randomly stumbled on the bodies while they were out for a drive.
Damn.
On their way back to Florida, Tony and John Murray stopped at a payphone on the border of Florida, and at 9 p.m., right on the dot, they called Becky at the payphone at the Jefferson department store. So she was hanging out in the department store waiting for the phone call to come through. Mm-hmm. And proud, Tony told her over the phone that they bagged two fishes.
Okay, great. They're like, we bagged two fishes. I think it's sleeping with the fishes. Fuck! Damn it! Are you kidding me? It's sleep with the fishes? That's what they're saying in the movie? What does that even mean? We killed your husband. And his stupid wife. We're coming home now. Damn it. The whole thing was about saying the fishes thing.
Nicholas, a good bit.
Thanks.
John Murray's confession to all of this helped investigators find all kinds of supporting evidence, like the contract for the rental car with Tony's signature on it. They were able to trace the phone calls between the payphone at 9 p.m. on the border of Florida to the payphone in the Jefferson department store.
So this story checks out entirely.
Like the entire
thing. Diner, everywhere they ate, people saw them.
Everything. And then like, for instance, this couple, that elderly couple, they were shown 15 photos and were like, that's the guy.
Yeah.
So while Tony and Becky Machetti denied all wrongdoing, the case was a slam dunk. Tony, Becky, and John Murray turned on each other. Tony said, this is the most obscene thing. He said, actually what happened was that weekend I decided I didn't want to go fishing or speculative real estate searching. I just wanted to go to the beach by myself and think. So he said he spent the whole beach, like time on the beach alone, but he let John Murray borrow his credit card and ID for the weekend.
Okay.
And Murray went and rented the Gremlin, forged his signature, and then like betrayed the family for insurance money.
Okay. Great.
Becky, for her part, said, I had no idea those guys were going to kill Ronnie. That was her main defense.
Okay.
They did it on their own. Again, you know, that Tony wanted the insurance money and they had schemed the whole thing out on their own, but she didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And John Murray said Becky had threatened to put a mafia hit out on his family if he didn't agree to be the getaway driver. So he was too scared to not do it. Plus he needed the $1,000. Now, I'm not going to go over all the, it was such a slam dunk. It's like the trials aren't even really that interesting. Yeah. Becky had the most absurd behavior out of the three at her trial. She kicked off things by telling everyone in the courtroom that she was, surprise, 3 months pregnant.
Okay.
Spoiler alert, she had had a full hysterectomy years prior. So she was not pregnant. Her lawyer actually came forward and was like, we have to take into consideration she's 3 months along. And then they were like, oh, actually we have her medical records. Did you know, sir? And then during jury selection, she walked into the courtroom carrying a giant book of prayers and then sat solemnly and like read through this book of prayers while they picked out the jury
members. All in Latin.
Yeah. It was like, what? In the end, Murray's version of the truth largely won out. In 1975, both Becky and Tony Machete were convicted of murdering Ronnie and Juanita Akins and sentenced to death. John Murray skipped a trial and pled guilty. He received 2 life sentences. But here's the thing. It turns out there's a lot more to this story, and it starts with the question, girl, where are your kids?
Mm-hmm.
Ronnie and Becky had 3 teenage daughters who knew way more than anyone else about their mother. These girls, Valerie, Victoria, and Vanessa. The 3 girls remained completely silent about their mother up through her trial and conviction, absolutely terrified to say anything to investigators. But years later, Becky's lawyers were able to win her a new trial on a technicality. And this time, the trial would feature testimony from her daughters for the very first time. And in part 2, we're going to tell their story starting at the very beginning.
Ooh, that's a cool reason to have a part 2.
It's absolutely fascinating.
That's so great. That, I mean, not great. None of this is great, but I just mean you're tricky. That's a cool storytelling mechanism. Like, oh yeah, it was a slam dunk case, except for all the kids were watching the whole time. The Hills Have Eyes.
Yeah, The Hills Have Eyes.
Okay, so part 2 is available on our Patreon or Spotify feed right now. Sign up. You know what I mean? Otherwise, it'll come out next Wednesday.
That's right. Hold on to your butts.
No, don't hold on to your butts. Let them go free, you know? I'm all about freeing the hole, you know?
Nicholas.
Muriel's Murders is entirely created by the 2 of us, Muriel Montgomery and Nick Castellini, right here in our Los Angeles apartment.
If you enjoy this show, we would love your support.
You can sign up for our Patreon at patreon.com/Muriel's Murders or through our Spotify feed.
Plus, you unlock 2 exclusive episodes a month and 1 non-true crime episode a month.
Check out Muriel'sMurders.com/support for more great ways to support our show that don't involve money.
All the links are in the show notes of this episode.
We love hearing from you. Our DMs are open and you can email us.
Our music is by Mario Castellini. Find him on Instagram at Castellini Beats.
If you are looking for a non-true crime murder podcast in your life, check out the Good Stuff podcast. This week's episode with Artemis Pebdani and Nazanin Noor is one of my very most proud episodes that I helped produce. Give it a listen. Give the podcast 5-star reviews and tell them, you know, Nick from Muriel's Murders sent you.
All right. We'll see you soon. Very soon.
Okay. That, oh, right now or whatever. Okay. We're looking at you. What am I saying? It's time to end. Okay. We love you. Bye.